welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week for your listening pleasure. And my very special guests today are Jerry and Kathy Wills. They are adventurers who seek out ancient places with a mysterious past. They document their travels throughout South America and put their videos up on their websites for others to enjoy. They have a lot of fun traveling and enjoying their life as they search for answers in strange and remote locations. So if you're not at home, if they're not at home in the US, you can be pretty sure that they'll be somewhere very off the beaten track, like deep in the Amazon, or at some remote mountaintop in the Andes, or at some ancient Rothschild sacrificial site. Jerry has also been a co-host of the Kevin Smith Show, but sadly Kevin passed on unexpectedly earlier this month, leaving Jerry and Kathy grieving his loss, along with many loyal Kevin Smith fans who are still mourning his untimely death. Now, I would like to now welcome them to the show. Jerry and Kathy, welcome.
Yes, hi, how are you doing? Thank you for having us on.
Yeah, well, quite well, actually, you know, considering.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah. Well, could you tell us a little bit about Kevin Smith, considering you were the co-host for a short period of time there?
Yeah, I was the co-host for a few years, actually, off and on. It wasn't a full-time position. It was just as Kevin, whenever he would need some help, I would sit in for him. Kevin was really quite a brilliant fellow to go on talk radio, and I think because of his background as a police officer and a detective, he had, of course, an inquisitive mind and a manner in which he would, ask questions. It seemed to get right to the heart of the matter. And, I think that's the reason why folks liked it so well. He was kind of a no BS kind of guy.
Rather ironic for a police officer.
Yeah.
Now, on top of this, there is a long history that you is Kathy even there?
Yeah, she is. She's right off to the side here. She's listening in.
Okay, okay. So I'm just basically going to be interviewing you, Jerry, and Kathy's just kind of like off to the side, you know, just listening in. All right.
She'll be vocal anytime now. You can count on it. When she has something to say, she'll be right there.
All right. Now, I have down here this recent trip that you had to Bolivia, May of this year, to hunt down ancient footprints set in rock. But before we get into that, I wanted to know how you actually started doing what it is that you're doing now, because you've come into these very interesting and strange fields with basically information that bends reality itself to a large degree, according to mainstream science. I was wondering, what gave you the kick, the nudge, the oomph to go and do all this kind of stuff?
Well, in my earlier years, I was quite a fan of different authors that addressed the ancient places and the mysterious things that were around the world, and it caught my interest, of course, I think as it did many others. It wasn't until early 1990s, I was invited to be a guest host on a trip that was going to Peru, and I had been invited to go along. My trip was paid for, and I would be there to talk to the people and, you know, socialize with them during the trip. I had never been, so I had no idea what I was in for. But I was very interested in going to Peru. I'd read so much about it. Daniken, all of his books, I'd read them. Sitchin, I'd read, you know, whatever he had available at the time, and others, you know, and I was excited. So that's how it all really started, going to South America. That trip was a great success. And at the end of that trip, the fellow who was putting on the tour said that he was retiring. He was no longer doing trips. And if I wanted to, I could take over the trips. He would give me his mailing list, his contacts, and so forth. So I jumped at the opportunity and started putting on my own versions of this trip. Instead of it being 8 days or 9 days. I turned it into 2 weeks and took folks on a fantastic adventure 2 weeks at a time and maintained that for well over a decade. It was during that period of time that, you know, you make a lot of friends down there, and these friendships became more and more solidified. My curiosity, of course, I was asking them about places that I'd read about, and they would tell me about things that they knew, and some of these things were not really on the tourist track, so I asked to see them. They eventually took me to see things that most folks don't see, and eventually took a video camera and made a short clip of one of them called the Temple of Time and Space. Pukhar is the name of it, the very first video. And a lot of our friends and family really enjoyed that. So we put it up online, and a lot of folks online enjoyed it as well, asking us to make more. We should be on the Discovery Channel, someone would say. So I contacted Discovery. They said, well, if you make, you know, 6 or 7 clips, we'll take a look and let you know if we're interested. So we did. Invested more into good cameras and equipment. Tried to refine the techniques of actually producing a short documentary. And at the end of a couple of years of doing that, and these were being put online, of course, we even moved to Peru at one point. We contacted Discovery and Nat Geo and some others, and they very politely but bluntly said they weren't interested. If they were interested in something like that, they would have contacted us, basically go away. Well, we decided, between Kathy and I, that we would make our own TV station. Don't need that. We can do it ourselves, and we did, and we created ExpeditionsTV.com. Since then, it's evolved. It's been since 2006, so it's about 7 years now, and we've evolved to Expeditions.tv, and we put all of our materials online. Folks can watch freely, and you know, we continue to go down and to do more videotaping, to produce more shows, you know, not as frequently as we would like, of course, but it's a costly thing to do. So this mention of having gone to Bolivia, we were down there and we shot 2 more episodes while we were there. That's how we got started.
Now, the impossible footprints in the sands of time of Bolivia. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, that was a really interesting thing. We were down there in 2008. One of our last groups, actually, because we've stopped taking groups down. But we were told while we were at on our way to Tiwanaku that there was a footprint that had been found, a human footprint, believed to be a couple of million years old, and that it was just recently discovered. So we asked our guide, who was an archaeological assistant, to find out more. He came back the next day and says, well, I'm told that it's on an island on the Bolivian side of Lake Titicaca, which would be the south end of Lake Titicaca, that the folks who own that island, the Aymara Indians, they're not very keen on having anyone go there. They're very protective of it. And if you went there, then they might let you see it, but there's no way to know for sure, and it's quite a journey to get to this island. Well, we pretty much couldn't do it. We were wanting to try, but it just was impractical given the nature of being on a tour with other folks. We never were told where the island was. So for the next, 4 years, 5 years, we were curious where it was, put out feelers, no one knows. Michael Cremo knew about it, but didn't know where it was at. So Kathy, because we were in Peru, we were shooting the Doomsday Stone and planning to shoot a continuance of Cumbe Mayo. So Kathy gets on what little bit of an internet there is and starts doing a search. And on a blog in Portugal, she discovers in Portuguese a reference point to where the footprint could be found. And of course, she translated it in Google and came up with the name. So she looked on a map and pinpointed exactly where it was. It wasn't an island after all. It was in the middle of northern Bolivia on the Altiplano. So at the end of doing some more shooting for Cumbamayo, we hopped a jet and flew to southernmost Peru and then went by land, overland, out to the Altiplano, northern Bolivia, following, you know, the trail, as it were, using a satellite map and a GPS to help guide us along some roads that were almost non-existent. And we eventually found the village and climbed the mountain, and there it was. Except it wasn't there, actually. When we got to the location on top of the mountain, someone had taken a rock saw and cut it out of the rock strata that it was found in. It was just gone. The people in the village, the Aymara, they said, yeah, well, there were some guys that showed up in a couple of trucks. They went up for about 6 hours. They came back down. They drove off, and our footprint was gone. This footprint to them was evidence of their ancestral connection, a very sacred thing. They didn't know who it was or why it was that had been taken. Well, we found out later that an archaeological team from La Paz had come in and cut it out and taken it into La Paz, put it on display for a couple of weeks, and after that, no one has any record of what happened to it. It just vanishes. Well, while we were up at the top of the mountain, Kathy decided that even though it wasn't there, she theorized, actually, that, well, if someone was here and it was a footprint, they had to have walked about, so there should be other footprints. Well, you'd have to see the location. It sounded absurd to me, but if she wanted to go looking, then why not? Well, within about 45 minutes, because she was looking specifically for it, I presume, she located two more footprints. One is so indiscernible, it really doesn't qualify as a footprint. It's just an odd-looking depression. But the other one is actually quite clear. And once we determined that that was actually a footprint, as best as we could, we geolocated it and started videotaping and documenting the site.
And in terms of the implications, what does a footprint in this particular location actually mean? I mean, how old is it?
Well, you know, as best as we can tell, because we're not really archaeologists or geologists, but there have been archaeological teams and geological teams there. They've dated this rock to be somewhere, and of course, I don't know how they figure this out, but they say it's somewhere between 7 and 15 million years old. And then others say 5 and 15 million years old. So there's a little bit of uncertainty as far as the age. It's rock, so I mean, how old could it be? I suppose it could be quite old. The original footprint, Bolivian archaeologists gave it a date of 5 million years old, and others have given it a date of 1.5 million to 2 million years old. This is in a similar strata of rock, so far as we know. It'll take more educated folks than ourselves to make that determination. It might actually be older than that. We don't know. But I think it's safe to say that it's well over 1 million years old and could quite possibly be quite a bit older than 1 million years old. But, you know, even if it's only 1 million years old, that really smacks in the face of accepted archaeological thinking that the bipedal humans who were upright and walking and thinking were more like 300,000 years ago and not 1 million, let alone many millions of years ago. It isn't accepted.
What's your impression of ancient cultures? Were they? There's some people going around saying that they were as advanced as we are today. And I think your speakers are a bit high there. Please turn them down. There's a bit of feedback. You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We're broadcasting live 5 days a week. That's Tuesday through Saturday in New Zealand and Monday through Friday in the USA and the Uber Kingdom and various other places around the globe. And you can find the archives at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's the only place you will find the archives of the Vinnie Eastwood Show at the moment. And if you donate financially or contribute something, you know, or whatever, we've got commercial free archives for you as well. Saves about, I'd say about half an hour of listening time per show. Adds up to about 10 hours of saved time per month or whatever. So, you know, you can do that for like $5 a month. If you like, or, you know, dollar a month, whatever. Just do something to support this broadcast, if you can, to show that you appreciate it and all the amazing, fabulous guests who have incredible stories to tell that we have on. And they donate their time freely as well. And I'm very appreciative to that, particularly of my very special guests who are notoriously difficult to get a hold of because of their career restraints, the late nights, and the huge quantity of work that they actually have to put out kind of like on a daily basis. Jerry and Kathy Wills. Now, I also wanted to, we were talking over the break about how, you know, you kind of keep late nights and you're doing an awful lot of work. And I'm just wondering, what's a typical day like for you?
Well, a typical day is really very crazy. Well, we usually get started somewhere around 9 o'clock in the morning. And, of course, we have Expeditions TV that we contend with to keep everything updated as best we can. We answer emails and take care of business until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. By usually 1 o'clock, we will have a bite to eat. That's our breakfast time, really. We keep working until around 6:30 or 7 on whatever the business is that's at hand, whether it's editing, preparing for a broadcast. I mean, there's so many different things. And then after that, we have something to eat, and if need be, we go back to whatever it is we were doing, and we continue working until 10 to midnight, and then we'll stop and be too tired to carry on, so we'll go to bed. That's how it is at home. When we're on the road, it basically is just nonstop, go, 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 go. And so we're always just on the move, it seems, you know, just it's exhausting at times.
Mm. And what was your, did you have a previous career prior to all of this?
Well, you know, my previous career prior to this, I operated an electronics company for about 30 years, and it was a much easier job, I think. And, you know, it's I'm not complaining that we have so much and we're on the go so much. It's just how it is. You know, we do enjoy what we do.
Mm. Well, in terms of this, can I ask you, what is your general impression of humans' past? I mean, you're not an archaeologist, you're not a geologist or whatever, but you have been to really a lot of amazing sites, seen some incredible things, and they must have left an impression on you about what early, way prehistoric man or even simply ancient civilizations must have been like. Are there any examples or stories that you might be able to share?
Well, there are a lot of examples. Anyone familiar with Michael Cremo's work And there are also a host of others out there who have spent a lot of time researching these things. There's enough evidence to support that something extraordinary happened in the distant past that caused civilization at whatever peak it had existed at that time to come to a crashing fall. And as far as what we've found and what we're looking for, the things that we've found support that. You see things that just can't possibly exist, but they do. And when you understand the dynamics of this, for example, rock that is cut with extraordinary precision, it's tens of thousands of years old. It was that old, you know, it was done that long ago with a polish that can't be achieved today. There's just so much evidence to support this. And the history that we've been led to believe is not the true history that occurred. And I don't know why it seems to have been directed in such a way that it would make it seem as though something entirely different happened in the past on this planet.
Has learning these things sort of opened your mind and changed the way you think about things?
Well, I think I always had an open mind, and I've always had an inquisitive attitude. It has reinforced my inquisitiveness, and it's reinforced my desire to keep looking. There's a lot of information. I mean, we just came across information this last trip that was mind-blowing, things we didn't even expect to find, and yet there it is. It was fantastic.
Well, like what?
Well, you know, I don't have exact dates memorized because it's all so new, but I can give you a thumbnail sketch. One example is this. Because we were looking for information, a little snippet of information came to us about a possible, they called it a castle, up in the highlands in the Andes in Bolivia. So we started doing some research, Kathy did, and it suddenly became clear that there were things that just didn't match up. For example, there's a place in Paraguay called the Viking Stronghold. Why would they call it that? Well, they call it that because there are symbols there, the language from the Vikings. We've discovered that there's... there's a village up in the Andes where they still worship Odin and speak a dialect from the Vikings' time. Well, what we discovered, by and large, putting little pieces of information together that seem to fit, that there's a map that we have assembled figuratively that takes us from the east coast of Brazil all the way across the South American continent into the Andes and to where the supposed castle is supposed to be, and plus a few other places. And along this line, there are sites like the Viking Stronghold. So consequently, we now see that the Vikings were involved in being in South America somehow. But it didn't finish there, because then we started wondering, well, who were these people who could do such extraordinary stonework, and why is it that it seems to have such a resemblance to what's in the Middle East? Well, with a little bit of extrapolation and a few more snippets of details, we started putting together that the people that were coming over here from the Middle East were the Phoenicians. And with the Phoenicians, there were refugees from some of the wars that were taking place. They came along with the Phoenicians because they wanted to go someplace else, offering their goods and services, their talents, in exchange for passage. Well, the Phoenicians were fantastic traders, and they were visiting South America for quite some time. They had set up trade routes. We'd already discovered this and know it to be an absolute. The absolute details we don't know, but the absoluteness that it occurred is in place. And now we suspect that the people who were building places, the fantastic places like Tiwanaku, Pumapunku, Machu Picchu, and a whole host of other places that string from Chile through Bolivia, through Peru, all the way, Ecuador and Colombia, that these people were the ancestors of those folks who came across with the Phoenicians and built these great cities. And truth is, when they talk about the Chechapoya, they're the ones that say were responsible for these cities. Well, the Chechapoya were tall, fair-skinned, red to blonde hair, blue and green eyes, and were quite tall. Not at all like anybody in South America. So, we've gotten these little snippets and started putting them together, and it's becoming quite a story. The thing that we've been trying to reconcile is what happened. What is it that occurred that took civilization and set it right back down to the first peg? And we really don't know. We have theories, but one theory is as good as another. We haven't found any absolute detail that tells us what happened. The only clear idea that we have is that something occurred that made the earth stop for 3 days. And when that occurred, the oceans went, lifting over the Andes and washing away people and things, leaving sandbars at 13 and 14 and 15,000 feet, like in the Atacama, where you have a sperm whale just up there at 13,500 feet, just buried in the sand with dolphins and fish and other things. So apparently,
according to archaeologist Jonathan Gray, that there's hundreds of thousands of mountain ranges around the world that have all sorts of remains on them that don't belong there, human remains, tools, sea creatures, land creatures, plants, etc., where there's nothing there now.
Yes, well, and I've been in touch with Jonathan. I think he's an extraordinary researcher. I really respect his work. Mm. And, there are these sites. Something definitely occurred. And there's evidence worldwide for this.
Mm. And this is what a lot of people have termed as the global catastrophe. And many ancient cultures record a great flood. I believe 187 older cultures record a great flood, not just the Bible.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, even in the Andes, you have the mythology of the great flood and how the shepherd boy was told by the star people that he had to go to the top of the mountain, go in a cave and seal it with his animals because there was going to be a terrible event that happened. The world was going to be flooded. And when it was over, he'd be able to come back out. When he came out, he was looking from the top of a mountain as though he were standing just slightly above the ocean before it receded. So there's a lot of stories like this everywhere.
Well, ergo, I mean, if there's that many stories, and they all tell virtually the exact same thing, surely it's not a theory anymore. That must have been what happened.
Well, that's what we think as well. But the classical archaeological attitude is that it's just mythology; it didn't happen, and let's go on to the next thing.
Mm. Which is ironic, really, because archaeology is about finding real artifacts and things of that nature, and many things have been found which support this. My question is, why would mainstream science and archaeology try and keep this thing locked down as a myth? What are they protecting?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? And I've wondered about that for a very long time. Why is it so important to keep the information away from the average person? what's back there in time that someone obviously doesn't want anyone else to know. And I just haven't got a clue. I mean, maybe it's something to do with where we are now and where we're headed, or perhaps something to do with how we as a people came to be in the first place. I don't know. I mean, it's in the same genre of questionability as UFOs, really.
There's this thing called normalcy bias, which I'm sure you encounter all the time. It can't exist because it doesn't sound normal.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really strange because, I don't know, I've been alive for 28 years, and most of the things that I've seen that appear strange turn out to be true, and most of the things that I thought were true turn out to be fabrications, lies, misinterpretations. And yet, society hasn't learned that same lesson that I've learned for some reason. Maybe it's because they haven't heard about things like what you're doing. Maybe it's because when you discover ancient mythology to be true, you wonder, I wonder what other myths are true, and I wonder what truths are really myths, and I wonder who would benefit from a society of people who don't question really anything of great importance. And we're coming on to break now, and we'll discuss this more after that one. Back in just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, with Jerry and Kathy Wells. Don't you go anywhere.
Unity, please don't desert me.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's a little bit about history repeating. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go freaking nuts. And we have about a little over an hour left to go in the broadcast, about an hour and a quarter with Jerry and Kathy Wills. And we were talking over the break about what the purpose might be behind the normalcy bias and concealing this kind of information from the public. I made the point that I believe that there are powerful people who have a lot of influence, who are deeply into the occult and are obsessed with control, who don't want this information necessarily getting out and becoming mainstream and being believed and known about by everybody. I mean, if a few people know about it, so what? Who cares? What can a few people do, right? That's a big mistake there. And the other element is, and I think, Jerry, you made this point, if humanity knew who we really were, what we really come from, then all sorts of faith in many forms of institutionalized religion, institutionalized thinking, and so on and so forth, all of these mechanisms of psychological control would be greatly damaged by this kind of knowledge becoming widespread. And Jerry, I want to know how you came to that conclusion.
Well, I think it's a matter of really examining a few things that have happened. I mean, there are people who actually have found things that were fantastic and substantial. There's one place called Vallisquejo in Mexico where a gal, an archaeologist, she was, you know, at the time, very brilliant, had high marks in her college, one of the top of her class. They found a mastodon bone in a site in Vallisquejo, Mexico, that had etchings on it, and they also found some spear points and some other small items that hunters might have used, or would have used, really. She studied the layers which are laid down in a geological, you know, timeline. She studied the bone. She studied all of this, and she came up with a figure that said this has got to be, and I don't remember the exact dating she gave it, but let's say she said this has got to be about 80,000 years old. Well, that's impossible, because at the time she made the statement, which was back, I think, in the 60s or 70s, the accepted age that it could possibly be, where there's etchings on bone, was somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15,000 years, 15,000 to 20,000 years in that region. Well, she pressed onward and said, well, look, here's this pollen, here's all this other stuff. And she dated all these things and came up with, yeah, it looks like it's about 80,000 years old. She was ridiculed, harassed. She lost her funding. Archaeologists work on funding from universities unless they happen to get lucky and have a sponsor, some philanthropist, which she didn't have. She was ridiculed to the point to where she quit archaeology, and she went to work in a different business arranging flowers. Because she was ridiculed so terribly, there wasn't really much work that she could get. Meanwhile, the site of Vallisqueo was closed down. Once it was closed down, it was done so by the Mexican government. No one wanted to touch it for quite a while. Within the past decade, a friend of ours has gone back in and started studying the details. He made a video presentation about this. It's called Vallisqueo. It's probably up online somewhere. And it's being now determined using helium isotope emission, which gives you a much better dating on things than doing the carbon-14 test, that this site is for sure 800,000 years old, maybe over a million years old. So she's proven, she's been proven that she was off by several hundred thousand years, but for sure she was well within the scope of what she knew at the time. To say that it was about 80,000 years old is actually 10 times older than that. So, you know, there's some movement afoot to keep people in line, keep them in step. Don't go against the party lines. This is the accepted truth, and we don't want to have the actual truth. We run into that, and it's unfortunate. And that's why we go and videotape things and make these programs, and we put it out there so a person can make their own decision. Here's what we found. What do you think?
Now, there's a number of things that come to mind there. Myself, for example, I'm kind of like a fly-by-the-seat-of-my-pants kind of guy. You know, if I say something and I'm wrong, I'll admit it and just go, look, I'm sorry, and then find out whatever the truth is. Others, on the other hand, are very meticulous, and they don't say anything unless they know it for a fact to be true. And if they don't know it for a fact, they make sure to qualify by saying, this is just a thought or this is just a theory. And they go over very, very thoroughly over things before they say and do and or release them. I presume this is what your methodology is.
Well, we try to be accurate. We try to present things in an unbiased way. But sometimes you find things that just smack you in the face as being, hey, you know, this is crazy. This is so old that what does it mean? So, yeah, we do try to be accurate, though. You're right. And we try to give the truth as best we know it.
And, of course, the difficulty is with your field, people won't believe the truth even if you tell it to them. In a lot of cases, will they?
Well, by and large, no. you know, there, of course, are those folks out there who are curious and willing to listen. I mean, let's face it, von Daniken sold a lot of books to people who were just like you and I, who are wanting to find out more. And if it's true, well, then that's really something. If it isn't, well, at least it was interesting to read about, and it got me to thinking. By and large, people would really like to know more. But the problem is that, you know, when you start hitting mainstream, there are two camps. There are the people... Actually, three. They're the people who really don't give a care one way or the other. Then there's the one on the other side that says, well, unless you have some degrees, you can't make a valid statement about anything.
Mm.
Then there's a larger camp in the middle, I think, who says, you know, I'd like to know more. What can you tell me? And I'll figure it out for myself from there. And those are the folks that we, I suppose, appeal to. But that camp doesn't seem to have the power to change public opinion because they're just like you and I. They're curiosity seekers, folks who just want to know more, and that's about it.
And not members of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes, exactly.
And the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderberg Group, and so on and so forth. Because, you know, it seems like, I don't know about you, but when the word mainstream comes to mind, I think of somebody just taking a leak on the truth. Really.
Well, I do that's too.
That's the stream that I see.
Yeah, well, that is the mainstream, and you're right. You know, I've avoided the controversial to a point. I didn't want to point my fingers and say it's because of these people or those people. And it's mostly because I don't have adequate proof to support such a claim. But, you know, when it comes right down to finding things that have no other explanation except that this happened. You know, like, for example, those whale bones and dolphin bones on the Atacama Desert up, you know, 13, 14,000 feet. Well, how did that get there? You know, it's mind-boggling. And why would someone, anyone, not want to say, yeah, you know, this happened and here's the details? But we run into it with all of these fringe things that we work with. The story about the city in the Grand Canyon. We were just with Scott Walter up there shooting a segment for America Unearthed, I think it is. And yeah, everybody thought, oh, it's just ridiculous. There's no city in the Grand Canyon. There was a story, and then it was proven to be a joke. Well, it wasn't proven to be a joke. We actually, Kathy, proved it to be factual by finding something that everyone else had missed and pointing to it and saying, look, you know, this isn't a joke. This is real.
That seems to be happening quite a lot. I mean, even I think I was at a protest a couple of weeks ago, and a guy was talking about how there's no cure for cancer, there's no cure for cancer. And I say, well, that's not strictly true. There's many cures for cancers. He goes, oh, yeah, but they've all been debunked. And they go, well, what do you mean? They've all been debunked. And the fact of the matter is he had no idea what he was talking about. Had no clue as to what I was going to say next, yet assumed that he did and had no evidence to prove his own claim and was simply attempting a despotic sense of ridicule so that other people wouldn't listen to me. And you think to yourself, you know, this is at a protest. This is where you'd expect people to have open minds. And the reality is, I think, over a long period of time, people's minds have been closed like clams, and forcibly so, through media, education. And when your parents have been indoctrinated by the same media and education, they're less capable of raising you to be an independent thinker. And so yeah. You get to the point where you realize that a large majority of people have been trained out of the possibility of having independent thoughts. Originality, and that makes them very easy to control. We'll be right back with hour number two with Jerry and Kathy Wills.
Everyone's asleep, everyone but me, and I can't help feel like I'm doing this.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously Fukushima irradiated island chained wasteland called New Zealand, where everybody has a part-time job as an energy saver light bulb, which according to the Prime Minister is good for the economy. My very special guest is Jerry Wills, and Kathy didn't seem to be having anything to say, so that's fine. And Here's something where we might be able to get Kathy to contribute on the pictures behind me. There's a doorway, an ancient doorway, somewhere in South America, allegedly, where you actually disappeared for some time, Jerry. You actually went into this this doorway. Kathy saw you disappear, and some kind of ancient being kind of like showed you the way back, sort of thing. This is pretty amazing. Could you explain it?
Yeah, it's quite a crazy story, and you know, I wouldn't believe it if I had heard it. It was terrifically surprising to me. The reason we were there is because, well, I'd been there a couple of times in years prior. Remember, I was saying we were doing tours to Peru, and sometimes we go to Lake Titicaca. And one of the Aymara guides had shown me this place. It was in the middle of nowhere, just off of a highway that was rarely used except by large trucks transporting goods from Desaguadero, which is the southern port of entry for Peru between Peru and Bolivia. So there was, you know, there's just a scattering of Aymara who lived, you know, through this region, but there wasn't very many people. Anyway, they showed it to me. I was fascinated by it. They were telling me fantastic stories about how people had disappeared into it, how they had seen people come out of it and then walk back into it again. Sometimes they were dressed in the ancient attire of robes and headpiece and so forth. And, you know, you hear stories like this and it's fascinating and you don't know what to make of it, but still you listen because it's fascinating. You know, if nothing else, it's their mythology and it's interesting. It was a few years after I had been there a couple of times already that I met up with a fellow near Machu Picchu in the village of Aguacaliente. It's a little village just below Machu Picchu. You go there before you go to Machu Picchu, actually. This fellow I met, his name was Pedro. He was an Aymara shaman, and at the time, I didn't know him from anyone. He was so insistent that he read my coca leaves that I finally acquiesced and allowed him to. Reading coca leaves is where they take all this big bag of coca leaves off the coca plant, mix them around, move the leaves, throw them in the air, let them land, they read them. It's kind of like reading tea leaves, I guess. Well, this fellow gave me a pretty interesting reading, saying things that were fantastic that I just didn't know how to get my mind around, because at the time I didn't know Kathy. I was married to someone else, had my electronics business, was doing the touring thing as a side hobby, really. And he told me that my electronics business was going to die, that my marriage was going to come to an end, and that I was going to meet someone who had hair like gold and the heart of the United States, who was, as he said it, the one. And she would be the one that would make all the difference in what I do the rest of my life. Well, I'm telling you this backstory so you understand that he had, these things did come to pass, and I had some respect for what he had to say past this point. We eventually became better friends on subsequent trips down to Peru, spent some time with him, and eventually got around to asking him some questions. I didn't want to do it immediately, you know, because there's some things that they hold as secret. They don't tell outsiders. But because now we had become good friends, I asked him about this strange doorway, since he's Aymara. He's from Lake Titicaca. Surely he knows of this place. And he said, yeah, he knows of it. And I'm paraphrasing. He said, there are people who use that doorway to go to other worlds, to other places. He says, I don't know. I've not really gone through it, but I've been there and seen it happen. Well, then how do they do this? How do they, because it's just a rock. How do they do this? So he said, there are three tones. And he says, I'll tell you this, but you have to swear an oath to me that you won't tell anyone. So, of course, I did. If it's BS, then, well, and I've sworn an oath to not tell anybody BS. If it's true, well, even more so important that I've had this oath. So he told me there are three tones that these people used. And sometimes Well, once there was a musician who sat there, and he was humming, and he happened to hit those three tones accidentally, and it just sucked him in, and he was gone, never to be seen or heard from again. They considered it very dangerous business to mess with this thing, and they actually don't even like being around it. They call it the devil's doorway. So he told me the tones, and he says, you've got to be very careful with this, because if you decide that you're going to try to open this doorway, we don't know how it works. We don't know what will happen to you. You might go away and never come back. He seemed genuinely concerned. Well, of course, I'm curious and not one to just believe that, yeah, this is a factual thing. I wanted to find out for myself. So I had, on that particular trip, I was going to Lake Titicaca, and I went to the doorway. I only made two of the tones. I didn't make three of them that time. And this overwhelming sense, it's like when you're dreaming that you're falling. This incredible sense of that overwhelmed me, and I pulled myself quickly away from the doorway and just got away from it. I needed to think this through, because how on earth could that happen? What is going on? By this time, I was with Kathy, and we were married. And I went with her on, what was it? I was like the end of November, or no, November 11th, that's what it was. We went there at 11 o'clock at night. Everybody was hot after the 11-11-11, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I thought, okay, well, maybe this is important. So we went there. Went there with a group of people who were our passengers. Now, there was a small group, actually. I think it was probably four or five others besides Kathy and I. And the whole intent of going there that late at night was to make all three tones to see what would happen. And I'm a little apprehensive, but I figured, you know, I really doubt anything is going to happen. So I got up there, and the overwhelming sense of dizziness and falling occurred, but I fought my way through it, kept focused, and kept making the three tones over and over and over until finally it felt as though it sucked me forward and I was just falling. Now, this is the point where Kathy was watching, and she could tell you what she saw, and I'll ask her to do that in just a moment. I was moving through what seemed to be the cosmos at an extraordinarily rapid rate. So fast, it just is mind-boggling. And within a very short time, I was deposited into a room, at least it seemed like a room, a quite large arena sort of place that was all white. I couldn't tell floors from wall to ceiling. It was like being suspended in a bubble of white. Although I could stand on the floor, I could tell I was standing on something. And trying to get my wits about me, because this just didn't even seem possible. Within a short time, there was a sound of a man talking as they were talking over an intercom system. And was apparently a bit surprised that I was there, asked me who I was, and I told him. And he welcomed me, surprisingly enough. I asked him who he was, and he said, well, we're the ones who constructed the doorway. And then went on to explain to me how they had made these doorways, and they interconnect through some means to other places on our planet, on Earth, and also to other worlds out there in the cosmos. And it sounds just like Stargate, so I apologize for that. But that's what he said. That's how this works. And that make the tones, it turns on the energy by resonating the silica in the stone, and it interferes with the energy running through there naturally, which I presume is that it's on a ley line It has a natural high potential. When you interfere with the electrical characteristics, that it sets something in motion, a bidirectional wormhole, perhaps, according to Dr. Michio Kaku, when I asked him about it. Well, and that sort of thing is possible, according to Kaku. So, you know, who knows? Maybe that's what's happening. Well, it seemed like I couldn't keep track of time. I wasn't sure how long I had been gone. And I became quite concerned because, after all, it was after 11 o'clock at night, quite cold at Lake Titicaca, quite dark, quite remote. Kathy and the others are there. Here I am, God knows where. And I want to go back. I've had enough of this crap. So I made it quite clear that I was frantic and very worried. I needed to get back, and I needed to do it now. And so the fellow guided me in the steps necessary. And the next thing you know, I'm traveling again, almost with just a flash. I'm traveling through the cosmos at an incredibly crazy speed. And there's a sound like a dozen tires losing their air while this is taking place. And I could breathe quite normally. Well, the next thing you know, I'm back, but I'm looking through the doorway as though it were clear, but I can't get through it. It's as though it were glass. So I rationalize I probably need to use the tones again, put my head against the wall, made the tones over and over and over, and finally it acquiesced and allowed me through. It released me. I was blown away, and I was scared out of my mind. This totally freaked me out. I had no idea that there was such a thing possible. So after gathering myself and gathering my wits, Kathy and I and the others who had seen this, we migrated back to the bus waiting for us, and it took us back to our hotel. And I really didn't talk about this very much for quite some time. I did talk to Kathy about it, of course, but didn't really go into it too much. It's such a fantastic story, but it happened to me, and I don't know how to validate it except to say that, well, it happened. I don't know.
And in the writings I got here, is it that Kathy saw you disappear? Is she there?
Yeah, she's here. She can tell you her version of this. Give me just a second. I'll put her on. All right, I'm going to move the microphone over so she can address you. Hold on.
Right, excellent. Because it's also very interesting when things like this appear, you know, very fantastical and what have you. If other people actually see it happen, then you know it's not just one person making it up. It's two people making it up. I was just kidding. All right, so, Kathy, do we have you there?
Yes, you do.
All right. Can you tell us what you saw on that night?
All right. Well, Jerry was easy to be seen because it was basically a full moon and or a very light with moon. I don't know if it was the full moon or not, so don't quote me on that. But it was a very light night, and he had a kind of a cream-colored winter coat on, so he was easy to distinguish in the darker area there by the doorway. And he knelt down in it, and I was sitting probably, I don't know, about 30 feet away from where he was, and he just started making his tones and things that he was doing with it, and I couldn't hear him making the tones, so I was that far away. But after a few minutes, he started to shimmer. And then all of a sudden, he just kind of like just vibrated out. He was not there at all. And that was pretty stunning because it was just like, really? And I walked closer to the doorway and looked to see where he was, and he wasn't there. And so I went back and sat on the rock that I was sitting on and just like was trying to get my wits about myself, thinking, okay, good, he went through the doorway, but what if he can't get back? You know, and so I started thinking about that because we just got married and it was starting to get a little bit, you know, feeling a little bit nervous about the whole situation, like, you know, starting to panic a little bit about it. And then
did you note down the time that it happened?
Well, we were there around 11 o'clock, between 10:30 and 11, I think it was, that he was doing this. We never stayed there past midnight because it just gets too cold. Mm. But, you know, we spend a couple hours there. So then as fast as I'm trying to, like, collect myself and rubbing my eyes and looking at the doorway, then he started shimmering back into place. And he kind of stood up and fell backward and stood up and looked around and looked up and looked at us and said, "Well, I'm back." And we go, "Yeah." And then he goes, "Okay, let's go." And so everybody just kind of gathered their things and left and didn't say a word to each other. It was really strange.
Well, it sounded like he just had a very traumatic kind of episode sort of thing. I remember I was on top of a mountain on Waiheke Island while there was a big fire going on, and I came back from that, and I wasn't saying anything to anybody, you know, because it's just what I'd seen in the fire.
Yeah, it's hard to process it all.
Yeah, well, it's hard to put it into words, really. Do you have any idea how long he was gone for? Was it like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 seconds, what?
It wasn't more than 5 minutes. I'd say, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, because it wasn't that long.
All right, Kathy, we're coming to break now. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the news.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, broadcasting live from beside a highway with gargantuan trucks and massive Harley Davidson motorbikes, just to interrupt us while we're talking about really important stuff. It's beautiful. Just beautiful. My very special guests are Jerry and Kathy Wills. Now, Kathy, I wanted you to continue on with this story about the Devil's Gateway or whatever. What was Jerry like? What was his demeanor like? Because you've been married to him at a time. I imagine you must have been really familiar with, you know, who he was as a man. And then did he come out and he wasn't the same man anymore? Or was it just in a state that of sort of shock? Or what was your assessment of his condition?
Well, he was kind of shaken to the point of just not wanting to talk about it. Because we were walking, you had to walk across this plowed field over to the van far down to the road, because it isn't as convenient to get there today as it was back then. But as we were walking across this plowed field, I said, "Jerry, you disappeared." He says, "Yeah, I know." And I go, "What happened?" He goes, "I can't talk about it right now." And I go, "Okay." And so it was a 45-minute bus ride or van ride back to our hotel, and nobody said a word the whole time. When we got back to the hotel room, he just started just regurgitating. I wish I would have had a recorder. He just started regurgitating all this information about where he was, what he saw, and all this different stuff. And it was amazing. And he had told you some of the things about how, you know, he focused on, his intention was to go to the Creator, and he ended up in this white room, lack of better description, and had a conversation with this voice. So, but I definitely saw him disappear and reappear.
And it wasn't just you who saw him disappear, it was everybody else that was with you. How many people were there?
I think there was probably about 5 other people besides Jerry and I.
Yeah. Just enough to kind of fill out a van sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Must have been pretty freaky.
Yeah, it was. But, you know, he he's had other experiences with, you know, contacts and visitations with other people not of this world. So, you know, it wasn't that odd to hear about this experience or see him go through this experience. It's just, you know, it's a different kind of experience. And, yeah, you could probably get lost real easily. And the realization of that is makes you a little bit timid to try it again.
Yeah, whoopsie. Speaking of things that people should try, coca leaves. And why should you chew them in South America? And what's the difference between coca and cocaine, Kathy?
Oh, well, coca leaves are very good to help move oxygen through your lungs better at altitude, and the people, the native people, use them constantly, and they're very good for helping with headaches, with being at a higher altitude when you're not used to it. You make teas out of it. It's very healing as the whole leaf itself. The problem is with the coca, the cocaine, is they take a huge amount of leaves and wash them with chemicals to get one particular alloy out of there and use that for their excitement of the white powder. So that's the problem, is they take one little chemical out of this wonderful plant, and then it's made illegal to use the plant itself anywhere else. It is a sacred plant in South America, by the way.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Well, I heard the World Health Organization did a cocaine study a while back to determine the usage of the coca plant around the world, you know, including the processed cocaine and the coca leaves and so on and so forth. And the results of this World Health Organization study is that cocaine's not bad for you at all. It's actually really, really good for you, as you've iterated here.
Cocaine, or not cocaine, it's coca, the coca leaf.
Yeah, yeah.
In its entirety, in its whole plant.
Yeah,
cocaine,
yeah.
And, is the derivative of, an illegal derivative of the coca plant.
And so naturally, seeing as the CIA ships a lot of processed cocaine around the world in order to fund its black ops and so on and so forth, the United States said, and the United States being the prime funder of the World Health Organization, said, don't release that report saying that coca leaves ain't bad for you, or we're going to cut all your funding. And so the report got buried.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's, and very, coca is still illegal today.
It's very good. We know a lot of shaman that use the coca plant and coca leaves to help people with drug addictions and also with diabetes and that type of thing. They work with people down there with that and have great success.
And why do you believe that this has been so suppressed? I mean, are there any psychoactive elements, like mind opening experiences and things of that nature, with just normal coca tea?
No, actually, well, it helps. It kind of gives you more energy because you have more oxygen running through your body. But it's. I have a video, a Coca Leaf 101, on our website on Expeditions TV that I did of me chewing coca leaves. And it did make me a lot happier because I had been traveling for 24 hours and I just got to altitude and off of a plane at 12,000 feet. And it did make me have a lot more energy, so it did make me happier.
Well, you know, it'll do that. It'll do that. Now, further on from this, there's also the healing. You said it was used to heal people. And apparently Jerry is a bit of a medical intuitive, kind of like a hands-on healer. Is that right?
Yeah, he is a energy healer, medical intuitive, I guess. I guess that's what he took to describe himself.
Could you explain a little bit about that? Is Jerry there at the moment?
Yeah, sure. Hold on. I'll give him the headset.
Because my mother's a bit of an intuitive herself. putting hands on people and being able to feel where the pain is, sort of thing, just by touch. It's really quite extraordinary, and a lot of people actually have this gift. And of course, mainstream medicine being the, I think, the leading cause of death in New Zealand, quite possibly in America too, they deny any kind of medical treatment that works or is outside of their paradigm. So that's pretty funny and interesting, isn't it? Jerry, are you there?
I'm here.
Right, so what is a medical intuitive, a hands-on healer, from your perspective?
Sure. Well, you know, from my perspective, a medical intuitive is someone that can, in some psychic sense, determine what's going on with a person that perhaps the medical community is having trouble with. And I try to work with the medical community to give them an answer or to give them a direction to look. I've done that on quite a few occasions. Medical intuitive then being someone who intuitively figures out, you know, a direction or a causation of something. Certainly not a diagnosis, but just an intuitive hit on it. On the other hand, being an energy healer is a little different, because in that particular regard, you use energy that flows through you, not from you, and you use that energy in a focused manner that causes changes to occur, you know, at a macro level, at best, a micro level at least. And these changes, when they manifest, all manner of things can take place. I've had quite a few folks that I've worked with who have had serious issues, and their issues just completely resolved within a very short amount of time. We're talking within an hour or less. In some instances, and in other instances, depending upon the condition. For example, a gal in Florida had a disc in her back that was blown. She was going to have surgery or else, you know, have this problem of pain forever. The work that I did on her took about 3 months to completely manifest, but the disc completely reversed and went back to normal, and she was fine thereafter. So, you know, there's no rhyme or reason to how quick or how slow something like this will take place. But, you know, and it doesn't happen for everyone, it'd be important to add.
Is it something that can only happen when you're in the physical presence, or can it be done remotely?
No, I've been working on folks worldwide for a number of years. I have a video here that was sent to me from some gals in Canada. I worked on one, and then the others contacted me. I worked on them as well. They got together and sent me a video. So I don't have to be in this physical presence. In this domain where the healing takes place, what I've noticed about it is a non-localized domain that is outside of time and space itself. It is really hard to explain, mostly because I don't know what the words are that I would use to explain it with.
Probably a creative analogy would be your best bet.
Well, then I would say that within the scope of what I do, you know, you have remote viewers, people who, you know, Ingo Swann was a very close friend of ours, good buddy of ours. Excuse me. And Ingo was great. He was unparalleled when it came to seeing something at distance. What Ingo and I decided, and he helped me to coin the phrase or the term, was it's remote presence, where I actually transfer myself to where the person is, and I work on them as though I were there, but I'm really not.
Astral projection?
Well, astral projection is possibly a way of explaining it, but this is more like, well, for example, I worked on a fellow, and he says, I really don't know if I believe all this, and so I poked him in the ribs, because I was on the phone, and he was in Finland, and I poked him in the ribs, and he let out a wallop and said, I just got poked in the ribs. And I said, yeah, that was me. So remote presence is a more physical attribute of astral projection.
Now, have you heard of a Fireburn Doctor?
I'm sorry, what was the term?
Have you heard of Fireburn Doctor? There's a website, fireburndoctor.com, where this guy can do what you can do. And he set up a hotline so that it, ironically called it a hotline, but if anybody gets burnt, you can take a picture of the burn or a quick video or something of that nature, or even just a picture of the person who's been burnt, and send them through to Fireburn Doctor, like right when it happens, you know, give them a call, they'll ring you back and message them IM or whatever. And he heals the burns. Almost instantaneously, the pain goes away. And if you've ever been burned before, like rather badly or whatever, you'll know this is just this intense pain because your nerves are literally on fire.
I've experienced that.
And so instantly the pain goes away. And then within a couple of hours or something, the wound disappears.
Well, that's magnificent. I'll have to look into this. I have not heard of him, but I intend to look into it. And you know, my goal has always been to do what I can to help folks by giving them an idea that what I'm doing is something as though they should be able to do it in themselves. That, you know, folks take a look at what I do, and probably Fireburn Doctor as well, and they go, gee, I really admire that. I wish I could do something like that. Well, I like to think that everyone should have this capacity. And this kind of ties in to the ancient archaeological things that we were talking about before, the ancient past. I think this was part of what they did, what they knew. And it's something that we should be aware of that exists innately within all of us.
Well, it occurs to me that many healing practices involve the use of tones and indeed the structure of the universe, as far as I've been kind of starting to conclude, is basically it's all energy, it's all tones, it's all sound, it's all mathematics. Ergo, anything that happens to you on this plane of existence, whether it's a liver cancer or a broken arm or a burn or whatever, if you know the structure of the universe innately, you can heal and correct those things without actually really having to do anything in the 3D world per se, as a lot of people would perceive it.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with that. I do. It's everything is energy, and including the person who's trying to help the other person. You know, it's in how you direct that energy. You know, how you see yourself. The biggest stumbling block, and I think this might lead us on an interesting path of consideration, because of all of the lamestream media and how things have been given so that we can follow a direction, confidence is the key. But if you don't have confidence, well, then you can't do anything.
We're coming to break now, and we want to pick this up right after it. Jerry and Kathy Wells are my guests, ladies and gentlemen. Back in a second. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's our final segment here with the quite lovely Jerry and Kathy Wills. And we were talking over the break about this kind of thing. It was about control and intention and confidence. And it occurs to me that when you're really this was sort of how Jerry was explaining to me how his ability to heal people actually works is because of confidence with the ability. And, you know, whenever you're walking into a construction site or something of that nature and you ain't confident and you're really tentative with a lot of things and you don't just go, no, we can do this, we can do that, such and such and blah, blah, blah. Sometimes you get into really big accidents. And it's not necessarily because of the fact that you were inexperienced. It was the fact that you were too tentative about it. You know? That's the funny thing about human consciousness is that a lot of it is based upon belief. A lot of your abilities based upon belief. And there are many people out there who have so little confidence in their abilities that they have to rely on other people to get their message out. And when that person doesn't want to any longer get that person's message out, they start attacking that person as though they're an enemy, when simply they're just refusing to help them anymore because they obviously can't help themselves. They don't have enough confidence. This is one of the main challenges I believe the human race is suffering from at the moment. As Anthony Robbins, the motivational speaker, said, humanity suffering from a crisis of faith, not in God, not in government, but a crisis of faith within ourselves. And I'd like you to, we've only got a few minutes left here, Jerry and Kathy, and if you have any choice pearls of wisdom or any hardship that you've been going through that you'd like to share at this particular moment, I'd encourage you to do so.
Sure. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You know, hardships come and go, so you know that isn't really much of an issue. The pearls of wisdom, though, I think are important because it might help people have a clearer idea on directing themselves towards something that's beneficial or useful. The first thing I want to mention is that there is a worldwide movement to legalize cannabis. And some people look at this movement with a tongue-in-cheek, oh, yeah, they're just a bunch of hippies wanting to get high. But, folks, I want you to know that there are hundreds of molecules in cannabis. They're called cannabinoids. And singularly, these different molecules go after things such as tumors, nerve conditions, pain. They help to regenerate and heal the body. They are magical substances that can actually do a world of benefit if you ingest the cannabinoids, in other words, eating it. Smoking it is not necessarily the only way or the best way. Eating it. Juicing it even is one of the best ways of getting the benefits from it. So that's one thing. The other thing is that, as we were just talking about, you and I, we were saying, you know, how people have a tendency to want to do something, but they feel a bit inhibited or tentative. It's not easy to have confidence. Because if you feel that there's a piece of information missing or there's something that isn't quite within the scope of your understanding, then confidence is difficult to attain. I think the most important thing you can do if you want to attain a sense of confidence is to believe, no, not just to believe, but to know yourself. Get to know yourself very well. Try things and do it with confidence. If you want to be a healer, or if you want to be a psychic, or you want to be a great writer, or whatever, stop saying, I think I can, because it's the same thing in your mind, inside, deep in your soul, as saying, I'm not sure if I can or not, but say, yeah, I can do this, and do it. Life is full of potholes, and you'll trip and fall, and you'll learn from them, and that's what it's all about. But don't lose your confidence. Know yourself.
Yeah, I have this this recurring sort of experience, you know, and I've got a lot of confidence in myself. I admittedly have a bit of an ego. However, I believe it's justified because of the things that I do and the ways in which I help society. Sure, I've got a bit of an ego. That's how I defend myself. That's how I say, hey, look, you may not like what I'm doing. You may not agree with what I'm saying, but at least I'm doing something, and at least I'm helping some people. I'm Vinny Frickin' Eastwood. Uh-huh. Do you get it?
That's perfect.
That's kind of what happens when you realize the power within you and that confidence within yourself is that you suddenly realize, my God, I don't actually really quite so much need anybody's help so much as I do need to believe in myself and believe in that that spirit of self-reliance. Like, there's nothing that can stop me because I'm committed, I'm determined, etc. This is, I think, a skill, a hard-earned, valuable skill that most people never attain because they never take the risk of being rejected, of being hounded, of being harassed, for fear that they might fail. Whereas failure is a blessing in disguise. Every single failure that you suffer through in your life often becomes a seed of success in other areas of your life. How do you feel about that, Jerry?
I completely agree. And, you know, as far as the ego goes, you know, there's all these, you know, New Age fluff types say, oh, you know, get rid of the ego. I don't think so. The ego is basically you being sure of yourself. If you're wrong, you say you're wrong. Oops, made a mistake. But it also is a very powerful force that carries you forward. If you let your light shine very brightly, and you do, it's obvious. But for those listening, if you let your light shine very brightly, there's going to be others who are going to notice this. Sure, there'll be some who'll criticize it, but who cares? It's not that they matter. You're not living your life to please them. You're living your life to be you. And if you let that light shine brightly, you can be sure that there are going to be other people who are going to find their way because your light was bright enough for them to find their own.
It's like a lighthouse, warning of rocks. And before we go, I've only got 2 to 3 minutes here. My producer, Mel, wants me to know, wants me to ask you, do you have any plans for future expeditions to South America or elsewhere?
Well, actually, we do. We're going to be going to Pennsylvania in about another week and a half to make a presentation to a college that we're hoping will fund us going back down to Bolivia to get a core sample of that rock and to get a plaster cast of the footprint. Aside from that, there are no other plans at this point, but, you know, things change all the time, and we never know what next week is going to bring. We're ready to go whenever we need to.
Mm. I found that planning usually limits opportunities in a lot of ways. Sometimes it's the only thing you can do in order to harness a particular opportunity, but often it limits them. You know, like, for example, if you're driving along a highway and you've got a plan to be by a certain location by a certain time or whatever, and you go, oh my God, look at that shop on the side of the road. That looks really awesome. Let's stop there. We might find some really amazing things that we want. And we're sticking to the plan.
Yeah.
You know, people sometimes rely on their plans so much as to exclude every opportunity that comes at them.
I agree. Be open to change and be open to opportunity because, you know, sometimes these things only roll around once.
That's right. Homeless people are very open to change, I found.
Yeah. So have I.
Especially since voting for Obama.
Oh, dear. Well, I can tell you it wasn't me that was in the masses that did that.
I remember I actually, I think this was before I'd woken up entirely, I actually believed in the fanfare and this whole, oh my God, we've got a black president. It's finally the rule of the tyrannical white man is over. No. Sorry. It's just an American president like every single other one of them, financed by massive corporations, lying through his teeth so that he can get power, so that he can, you know, do whatever the bigwigs want. The bigwigs that never change, no matter if the face of the president does. Now, Jerry, thank you so much, and Kathy, you too, for coming on the show today. And I wanted to give your website out for the listeners. It's expeditions.tv. That's just X, the letter, peditions. .tv, like the road to expedition, and jerrywills.com. So expeditions.tv and jerrywills.com. Jerry.com are the websites, ladies and gentlemen. You will be able to find a remarkable amount of information that these two have made for your consumptive pleasure. Let's hope that the content finds its way onto your screens, and let's hope that the intention for which it was put up there to enlighten and to expand consciousness and to accept that we don't know everything about the world also filters through as well. Jerry, Kathy, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Do you have any parting? Do you have a parting shot for the audience?
Yes, I'd like to. I'd like to thank John Shooter at Coastal Computing in Spain. He's the reason why Expeditions TV is such a remarkable website. And I'd like to invite anyone who needs something to consider him as a resource. And for everyone else, for any other reason listening, thank you. It's been a privilege to be here with you all today.
Okay. Jerry and Kathy Wills, ladies and gentlemen, again, those websites are expeditions.tv and jerrywills.com. You've been listening to another extraordinary broadcast of The Vinnie Eastwood Show. Archives available at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. There's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't. Go ahead, make my news, and we'll see you again sometime, folks.